In the West, there are still a few good men left. Men of God, like the circuit-riding preachers of old. Proclaiming truth like the holy prophets of old. Strong and bold. You're about to hear politically incorrect, but biblically correct truth from circuit-riding preacher Peter Peters, whose home base is a radio ranch nestled in the Laramie River Valley near Laramie, Wyoming. The Radio Ranch is a working cattle and horse ranch where circuit-riding preacher Peter Peters broadcasts nightly worldwide on the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network, reaching the world through satellite, radio, television, shortwave, and the World Wide Web. Riding for the brand, he preaches for the man, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. His circuit not only includes a radio ranch outreach in Wyoming, but also the LaPorte Church of Christ, located at the base of the colorful Colorado Rocky Mountains in LaPorte, Colorado, where he has preached for over 30 years. The messages preached there by Dr. Peters on Sunday morning are streamed live on the internet and are archived at the ministry website, scripturesforamerica.org. Dr. Peters' politically incorrect but biblically correct sermons are available on CD and DVD. Many in America, Canada, and all over the world are on the free CD and DVD ministry. Our address will be given at the end of this broadcast. And now, here is Dr. and Pastor Peter John Peters with the Word of God.
Well, it's always so sad that the time has to run out and we have to go back and home. And of course, we always have the next camp to look forward to. And praise be to God. There will be another one. In the book of Job, chapter 10, and verse 8 through 10, it says this: "For inquire, I pray thee, of the former age, and prepare thyself to the search of their fathers. For we are but of yesterday, and know nothing, because our days upon earth are a shadow." So, with that scripture, I would like to reiterate again the point that victor always writes the history. The loser doesn't get much to say. Somewhere in between is the actual truth. And of course, our job is to find that true history of our people, find where we went wrong, why we went wrong, and what we must do to correct those errors. The last two messages, I've tried to bring it to us so that we would see, one, that what happens to even Christian people, even our people before we turn to Christianity, what happens to us when we do anything but try to plant the kingdom of God. I showed also what happened to a nation as just one example. When you protect and give special privileges to a group that are openly anti-Christ. And in this message, I would like now to show and bring forth what has happened in America, and then give another example of our people, even Christian, what has happened to them and what they did about it when we again allow anti-Christian forces to rule our nation. As we take a good look at our country today, we see a cancerous, hollow shell of a once mighty Christian nation. And I don't believe that anyone among us, anyone on the streets of America that has their head screwed on tight at all, could deny that statement. Our forefathers had a nation of men, women, and children who could hold their heads high, and they could be proud to say, "I am an American." But now, even the word patriotism itself is not taught in schools, in the public meetings. Patriotism has become a no-no word. It has even become the in thing to protect anyone who burns the flag. At the same time, it is no secret that we are no longer allowed to display our Christian heritage in public buildings, on public property, public schools. We can't do that anymore. We can't even put the Ten Commandments on the wall. We have fallen so low, in fact, that our government, that we are forced to pay taxes to, fund organizations that support dollars, and with support dollars that support artists that draw paintings of the crucifix floating in a bucket of urine. Your tax dollars do this. We, as Christians, have fallen so low. The loss of her pride of telling anyone in the world that I am an American, and the loss of our Christian heritage go together. If we had our Christian heritage back, if we could be proud to say we have a Christian nation, we could also then automatically say, I am proud to be an American. They go together. When you consider that to God a thousand years is as a day, about 125 years is not very long. It's just like that to God. And really to those of us, as we live our life, it's not much longer than that. We can say that America started its downhill slide starting just after the Civil War. Somewhere around the Civil War was the start of the real downhill slide. And since I personally have lived nearly half as long as the time from the Civil War to now, I can authoritatively tell you that that's not a very long time. It goes very fast. The constitutionalists will tell you, and accurately, that it was right after the Civil War that they were forced upon us, the 13th and 14th Amendment. That's true. But that is only a product of the cause. It wasn't the cause, it was the product of the cause. We can say, why stop with the 13th and 14th Amendment? Why don't we just go ahead and say all of the rest of them after the Bill of Rights, after the first 10, include all of them in there? But they are all a product of the cause. It wasn't the cause that did it. It wasn't the Constitution that made America great. It wasn't that piece of paper. It was the Christian ethic that made America great. Even with the faults that was within that document, America worked its way around those known faults and lived with them, and it was because of Christian ethic that they did these things and made America great. Thomas Jefferson said it, same thing in another way. He said that when things begin to go wrong, the good sense of the American people will make it right. Now that is just street language for a Christian ethic. He said exactly the same thing. The good sense of the American people is a Christian ethic. The underlying cause of our problems today is nothing new. It has happened before. And just like it has taken the United States about 150 years for the average citizen to begin to understand the oppression and the rule of tyrants that are ruling over us. About 150 years it took us to understand this. It took the people of England almost identically the same thing, the length of time, to be sufficiently suppressed and oppressed that they went to King John at Runnymede. It was the same period of time. They had the sword in one hand and the Magna Carta that they had written in the other. And they went to King John at Runnymede. It took about that length of time to get them sufficiently oppressed, suppressed, and indignant, upset to do this. They were a slow people to rise to anger. We are a slow people to rise to anger. Surprises of all surprises. Guess why they went to Runnymede and went to King John? It was the identical underlying cause that led them to force King John to return to a more Christian ethic in a government. It was a Christian ethic that they wanted back. They had lost their Christian ethic. They weren't a Christian nation any longer. And it was the head of the Christian church in England that led the rebellion. Pardon me. In this message, I will compare the decline of the United States since the Civil War with the decline of England from the time of William the Conqueror to the incident at Runnymede. We will then understand the underlying cause of why the Christian ethic was lost and a foreign system of government and society replaced it. Thank you. Starting around 1870 in the United States, the ethnic composition of the United States started to change. And it started very as a trickle at the very outset, just very slowly. And then by the turn of the century, it was a landslide. From 1870 to 1913, 1918, it became a landslide. I am speaking of the Ashkenazi Jew of Khazaria in Eastern Europe that came into this country, first a trickle, and then as a landslide, over 10 million. The history books are full of how this took place. Most of it was illegal entry. Some of it was legal. But they came in during that period of time. And along with these people, there were other peoples that were living in that area that had already, in their own mind and in their own ethic, in their own heritage, even though they were ostensibly and were Christian, they came with a Talmudic concept of government that compounded the problem. But it was the Talmudic Ashkenazi that brought the system, the idea of a different system of government into the United States. There are many people in this country today who have a Christian background. They go to a Christian church, but they believe in a Talmudic concept of government, a Talmudic concept of society. And it is because of the indoctrination of the Ashkenazi from Eastern Europe and Russia that brought that concept with them. Today we call it Zionism. Paul said, "Be ye separate," and he meant it. And as we look back in history, over and over and over again, be ye separate. It is very hard to get our people to understand this. It'll be the same end result every time. It is the Talmud and its way of life that all of these people brought with them that has changed our Christian ethic. I remember right after World War II, I joined World War II in Indiana. Joined the Army in Indiana. Wanted to be a paratrooper, and my brother and I both went down to sign up as paratroopers. I couldn't be a paratrooper because even at that time I wore glasses. So still, in as much as I enlisted, my family never were drafted. I joined the field artillery and went into an infantry division. But I came after the war. I returned back to the Southwest here because I had trained out in the Southwest and met my wife here in the Southwest, and we married in the Southwest. And so after the war, I came back because I love the Southwest. I love the West, the people of the West. I adopted the West as my new home. I came, as I pointed out, from the Midwest, and it was an industrial city. I lived there, of course, only 17 years. But in those 17 years, I became very accustomed to a Talmudic way of life. There were rules for everything, and everything and everybody was regulated. I didn't know it. I didn't even recognize it. It was just a way of life. The people waved the flag, and I waved the flag, and they were told that they were free, and I believed it. I thought I was free, because I didn't know any better. I went to the Southwest, and I was utterly amazed. Here were white Christian people living in a way of life that was totally strange. That is strange to me, totally strange. I didn't understand it, but I loved it. It seemed that you could do anything that you were man enough to, as long as you didn't hurt anybody. And when you did hurt somebody, I very quickly noticed that when you damaged somebody, it was the white Christian people of the West that came down on that person. The Western heritage had always been that way. Vigilanteism out in California was a result of the white Christian heritage when you had a system of government that went awry. I loved it. There was no intervention from Washington, no intervention from the intervention of the Eastern way of living in America out in the West. I knew that at the time many of our men, not because they needed to, wore a sidearm. They just put it in a holster and wore it right on the belt. You could see it just practically every day as you went up and down the little streets at the small towns. They didn't need it, but they wore it because they knew they had a right to wear it. But it also sent a message to a would-be lawbreaker. It sent a message to them. And if anything happened and they were required to use it, the lawbreaker was the one that was still in the wrong. And that righteous person wasn't hauled off to jail as he would be today. That was in the United States of America, even following World War II. I was amazed at the total lack of regulations and laws for every little thing. And of course, I took to it like a fish takes the water. I loved it because it was a real Christian way of doing it. I didn't know the difference between Talmudism and the Christian ethic at the time, because I wasn't yet a Christian, even though I was born and raised a Methodist. But nevertheless, I took to it like a fish takes the water. But then I started to notice little changes take place. People would come in from the Talmudic section of the country and would immediately say, when they saw something that they didn't like, just little things, you would say, well, what's the difference? That's not much. You can put up with that. And they immediately said, there ought to be a law. And I said, no, there doesn't need to be a law. We don't need to be regulated. It takes care of itself very well. Leave it alone. No, they persisted. They just had to have a law. I tried to tell them this, but they would go to the town hall, they would go to the state legislature, they would go to every meeting they could and persist in pushing for changes in this beautiful system of where you could do anything you were man enough to, just don't hurt somebody. And so, of course, you know what happened. You know the rest of the story. A little bit here, and a little bit there, a little bit more, and it just starts growing like a cancer. Now, I noticed that in the old system that there weren't any zoning laws or housing codes. The Christian ethic of do unto others you would have them do unto you was extant in the country. You would notice home builders in one area that would try to build homes in that given area that would be compatible and of the same type and level, not type, design, but of the same quality as others in that given area. But if someone came in and built a home that by your comparison was a shack, it wasn't a capital case. You didn't make a great big to-do about it because he had rights, he had liberties, he had freedoms. And was he really hurting you just because your aesthetic outlook on what you thought was beauty was damaged? He wasn't hurting you. But now, it's not that way. At first, I couldn't quite understand it. I didn't understand why. Well, gosh, I mean, why would that person move in and build a lesser house right in there with this other? Because I, too, was brainwashed. I thought, you know, really, we ought to have a little bit more commonality in types of houses. Just as an example, the zoning of houses. Today, there's zoning laws for everything. We even have extraterritorial zoning laws in some of the cities where a city has an incorporation up to a given boundary. They have the right to make extraterritorial zoning regulations out in the county, even to the extent past the county lines. A city can do this in certain areas because of the Talmudic encroachment on the Christian way of life. Even now, a dog catcher can go into some of the counties, go out into the county roads, go right with his little truck with a cage in the back and his snare and all this kind of stuff, go right up onto a farmer's ranch yard and pick up the man's dog and throw it in the back that's on the yard, not out on the road, but in the yard, pick up the dog, throw it in the back of his truck, take it to town and pound the dog and find the owner. Back when I first went there, the dog catcher would have been shot. And he'd have gotten by with it. The Ashkenazi has traits that we Celto-Saxon Christians do not understand. He lives under a combination of race and religion, just as we do. It is the Talmud that regulates him. That is what tells him his idea of social laws, what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is evil. But it is the race, the Ashkenazi race, that drives him. He is tireless in his efforts to force upon wherever he lives, force his way of social living on the entire community. It's within him, down deep inside of him, that drive to force it on everywhere he goes. And that is history. It's been always that way. He wants to rebuild the society in his own image. One of the first things that they did when they came to America, starting in 1870 and shortly thereafter, was they sent their children, particularly their boys, to the best schools available. They taught them to the professions of the robes. They became lawyers, They became judges, they became congressmen, they became senators, state legislators, doctors, teachers, professors. They took on the robes. They took on the leadership. Now there's some lessons here. You must understand the lessons that we're putting out here. In one generation, the laws of America began to become compatible with the Talmud. In one generation. In addition to this, they were very clever. They opened up the immigration laws. They changed the immigration laws tremendously to allow for more of those people to come in and for more of other colored peoples to come into this country to give you the great melting pot, the unbelievable melting pot concept of America. And that what we have today in the concept of immigration laws in this country is a direct result of Talmudic thinking. It is their concept of social life. That's what they know. The Talmud is complex and it is lengthy. It is a compilation of thought of their rabbis over many, many centuries. And it is the very thing that Jesus preached in Matthew 23. The biggest share of Jesus' ministry was against Phariseeism, Talmudic Phariseeism. He was trying every way he knew how to show the difference between the Talmud and the Pharisaic way of life to the Christian way of life. He was showing us what would happen if you did it their way versus our way. The parables of Matthew 13 are full of the comparisons between the Talmud and the Christian ethic, the Christian way of life. It is the major portion, the major thrust of his ministry in the social sense. It would be impossible for me to recite just any, even a small portion of the Talmud. It's in 63 books, the Sansino edition is, and it's translated into English. You can get it. You can get it from Omni Press and other places. It's somewhat expensive. It's around $400 and some for the 63 books. But you would be utterly amazed at the social ethic that is in that set of books. If you could even go together, group of you, and get one so that you could get a set of them so you could compare, it would be very wise to do so. In this, I'll just, though, however, give just 2 points to kind of just sum it up to show how these, what the whole concept of the thought in the Talmudic thought pattern that has been impressed upon us so that we can see the social system that they have to offer. The Talmud says, according to a very well-known rabbi, and I'll just give 2 points, it summarizes it. The growth of Talmudic law in all its aspects was the work of judicial interpretation rather than of formal legislation. Now, understand, rather than formal legislation by a lawgiver, it is judicial interpretation of that formal lawgiver. The rabbis who were called upon to administer the old law, and that's the laws of God, reckoned with the conditions under which it was to be applied. So they took the law, statutes, and judgments of God and said, no, we can do better. These were the law, statutes, and judgments of God, but now we're going to take and apply them to the conditions. Certain system or conditions extant and existent at the time that we were talking about. He continues, if they thought the mechanical application of precedent in conflict with the demands of equity, laws of equity, they resorted to reinterpretations. The case so decided then became precedent for parallel situations. The legal code of the United States of America is exactly what he's talking about here. The judge served in effect as a creator of law and not only its interpreter. there is only one lawgiver. But they became the lawgiver. And then they have the intestinal fortitude to say, this phenomenon has been duplicated in every system of jurisprudence. They're bragging about it. Just exactly as I pointed out a moment ago, they would come in and ever so slightly at first, then they would say there ought to be a law, and they come in with more, and there ought to be another regulation, etc. They start very slowly and just keep building and building and building to a crescendo until they get a system of jurisprudence that is a direct copy of just what I read. It is done every time. Rabbi also says this, Talmudists declare individual property rights as subject to their consistency with the public welfare. When it is to serve the public interest, these rights may be modified or suspended altogether. Now that is a Talmudic concept, and you are living with it. That is the Talmudic concept that says that you have eminent domain, government has eminent domain over every bit of property you have. If they want to build a park, they build a park. If they want to take it for no matter what, they take it for no matter what. They have the right over your property. Now, if you think about these two points, we can see very readily why every law that we have, every regulation we have, all of the codes we have, all the licenses we have, and all of the government officials in every alphabet soup of organizations that we have in America today comes from Talmudic thinking. It is that concept that we now have as a government in America. Now conversely, we as Celto-Saxon Christian Israel, if we are left alone, we are a laid-back people. Jesus tells us to be a laid-back people. Jesus says to forgive 70 times 7. And if we are left alone, if they would just get out of our hair. We would do just that. We would forgive 70 times 7. The Word of God says that there's only one lawgiver. And we believe that. And we believe that the only purpose for the judges is to adjudicate down in our hearts. It's here. Hebrews 8:8, Jeremiah 31. That the only purpose of the judges is to adjudicate against the great lawgiver. And if we're left alone, that's the way it would be. There are no shades of gray. We as a people look at society differently than does the Talmudist. And let me say that when I say the Talmudist, I am talking about the Ashkenazi, the Sephardic Jews themselves, and I'm also talking about the so-called Judeo-Christian ethic. If it weren't for the exorbitant Judeo-Christian people who believe in the Talmudic concept just because the Jews believe in it, we wouldn't have the problem. For fear of the Jews, many became Jews. And Jesus said that you seek far and wide for one proselyte. And when you have found him and you have made him a proselyte, you make him twice the child of hell. In my thinking, deductively reasoning this, the one who is twice the child of hell is the Judeo-Christian out there that is pushing, selling, shoving, and forcing down my throat Talmudic government. And as far as I'm concerned, there, at that point, is where we should start looking. When Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 3:10, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. The Talmudists don't believe that. Therefore, we are laws. Anybody can be on welfare, and he doesn't have to clean the streets to get it. It's his right, you know, to be on welfare. And it's your right to pay for him to be on welfare, and he doesn't have to work to get it. The scriptures are very clear that we have the inalienable right to pass on property to our children. The Talmudist doesn't believe that. And our laws on inheritance are being modified daily to the point where either because of taxes or some other chicanery, you can't pass it on to your children. It's not even worth passing on to your children. Christian Israel believes in the death penalty for those crimes where there is no restitution. The Talmud doesn't believe in the death penalty. Thus, the death penalty for non-restitutional crimes such as murder, rape, homosexuality, kidnapping, etc., you don't get that. And even if there was a death penalty, it's generally given, there is generally for the wrong reason. Christian Israel, from the earliest of days, didn't allow for usury. But because of Talmudic influence in governments and impressions on kings and governments alike, we have started making the practice of bringing the Talmudist in to use his money. In the name of the king, they brought in the Jewish money lenders. And it was always a fight between the church and the government over the Talmudic practice of not only usury, but all of these other things that took place. So many of our people, not only just we in the identity movement, but many others are beginning to realize that the system itself has allowed for its own destruction. And these are facts, and we know it. And of course, more and more people are turning to the works that Thomas Jefferson wrote when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. More and more people are beginning to read just what the Declaration of Independence says. Yes, it happened before and more than once. And it's always for the same underlying reason. Some of the facts surrounding the fall of Rome has never really been known. But as we study the books, the history books themselves, such as Gibbon in the Fall and Decline of the Roman Empire, is very, very open to say and talk about the Jewish influence in the Roman legislature. Very open about this. And he stated unequivocally that it was because of them the Roman Empire started and made its fall. So there was a prime example. And yet we go into Washington right today and we see the Corinthian, the Ionic, and the Doric pillars and the gargoyles, etc., and the great big elaborate Roman-style buildings right there in Washington, D.C. When in reality, we ought to have something more like a Butler building. They work for us. Other books such as Ammon's Jewish influence in Roman legislature is telling us now just exactly the influence that the Jews had in the Roman legislature. So it's not new there. It fell because of Talmudic concepts. When William the Conqueror invaded England in 1066 and he overwhelmed the country, he brought with him an entirely new government, a new social, and a new economic system. He brought it with him, right out of France. The people of England, at that time, never fully accepted it. And they finally overthrew it. And that was at least for a while. Until they allowed them back in again. Before William the Conqueror, life in the English countryside was very, very simple. Nearly all of the information that we can gather all come from the deeds, the wills, and the other church records that was extant in England at the time prior to 1066. It is in that period of time that we can see something that the people lost and they wanted back. It was a nation of mostly free landowners. They owned their land in a loyal title. A loyal title means you own it. Nobody owns it, and you don't pay taxes on it. It's yours. The land belongs to God. The earth is mine, saith the Lord. And you are the steward of it, but you own it. And you can pass it on to your children. And you don't have to have a tax added to it to pass it on either. If you didn't own your property in a loyal title, you own it in fief, F-I-E-F. That's where the word fiefdom comes from. The land is actually owned by the government, be it a king or a constitutional government or a parliamentary form of government, whatever it may be. If you own it in fief, the state owns it, and you then just simply pay a tax, which is a rent, and then you are allowed to use it. But the king or the government really owns the land. You just can use it. Don't pay taxes on your property for 3 years, and you'll see who owns your property. Each little town, called a toon, consisted of about 30 families. About 30 of them were centered around the centerpiece of the city. And in that center were the shops and the trades, the blacksmiths and the manufacturing trades and things of this nature. And there was a lot of manufacturing there, but there was manufacturing that was sent to other parts of the world right out of these little tombs in Celto-Saxon England. And at the center of the town was also their churches, and their churches were involved with the government. They didn't run it. The churches didn't run it, but they advised it. And they were present at all of the meetings. Each family of these 30 around the tomb would farm about 120 acres. It was called a hide. They rotated their crops just as the Bible dictates that they rotate their crops. They had the systems of captains of tens, captains of 50s, and captains of hundreds. Where have you read that before? They had that system. Every 100 freeholders would meet at 4 week intervals, and the meeting would be attended by the local church leaders. These groups of 100 freeholders would then vote on their leader, captains of hundreds, and they would go on up to the next group, and it would be called a shire, in which, in our terms, would be a county. In charge of that shire, that leader that they elected would be called the earl. The second in command would be called the shire reeve. It's called the sheriff. Today, the sheriff just answers to the to the county commissioners, and he's just there to go out and bring cases to court. Bring warrants and so forth and so on. That's all. On top of that, they elected the leaders of all of these groups, of the various shires, the various counties, and they would be called the Witan. They were elders in Israel, and they were the older men of all of these shires. They would elect the leaders, and they were called the Witan. And the group of the Witan would actually elect the king. Now it was that way. So that was a republican form of government. Do you see the republicanism in there? Oh, would be to God that we had a Republican Party. Would he begin to do that? All right, so that is the way it was. And of course, from that, they also formed their national army, and it was called the Third, F-Y-R-D. Well, William the Conqueror changed all of that. He brought with him the Talmudists from France, and they were, of course, the first thing, his advisors. Or have you heard that before? They were the government's advisors. The first thing the king did when the Talmudists advised him, of course, was to confiscate all of the property and make it a fiefdom. You didn't own it in a loyal title. The government owned it and you paid taxes. The next thing that King William did, under advice of course, was to allow the Jews to lend money. They lent the money to the empire, to the king, to his government, and they lent it to you and me as individuals, if we were sucker enough to do it. The money lent to the empire was paid back by the taxes from the fiefdom. Now, out of that system, within 100 years, the Jews, going in with William the Conqueror, owned 1/4. 100 years, they owned 1/4 of all of the property in England. Now, think about this. I mean, this is pretty clever. And the Christians were dumb enough at that time to allow them to do it. Now, theoretically, it didn't include the land, but they even bought up the land under fiefdom. And it was all right. It was a kind of a symbiotic relationship. It was all right for them to do this because the government gave them special provisions. They set up special laws that applied only Jews. And they allowed them to do certain things that you and I as Christians could not have done. They protected them and allowed them to do things that you and I couldn't have done. And then they had a special court to adjudicate this entire situation, the relationship between the Talmudic Jews and the Christians. And they called it the Star Chamber Court. How many of you heard of the Star Chamber Court?
All of you.
Star Chamber Court. And the reason we look at it with horror, we know back in our hearts and what we read, oh, it wasn't a very good thing. And we read about that, and we know it was unjust and wicked, and it was always because the adjudication was in favor of the Talmudist. Just as it is today with people like Ivan Bosky and Milliken and the savings and loan fiasco, etc., etc., etc. The same provisions are made today as was made there before or after William the Conqueror took over England. William the Conqueror and the Jews immediately set out to loan the government and money to build beautiful roads, expensive stone bridges, public buildings, churches, Christian churches, beautiful edifices, the cathedrals. And history books will tell you that it was the biggest advance in social living in all of English history. These marvelous people with this marvelous concept brought in all these marvelous, wonderful inventions to the English economy and social living. Now, of course, all of this was on borrowed money. And all of this was losing your freedom and losing your rights. You were in fiefdom. You didn't own anything in a loyal title. You had regulations for everything. You couldn't inherit your land anymore because you didn't own it. And so the people were getting tired. The king was advised to confiscate property, even that in fiefdom title. And they built national forests that were set aside, and they built new national forests, which were, before that, just in farmland. And of course, we have the Wilderness Acts of today. Exactly the same thing. They're not one iota of difference as to what is going on right now as to what went on over there. There were meetings, deep tired of it. Meetings, riots, uprisings. And it was the church leader in each district, just like before the Revolutionary War in America, the church leaders in each district was telling the people what they were doing wrong, what was wrong with the system, and what had to be done about it. Finally, at Runnymede, in 1215, it all came to a head. The Norman King John was presented with the ultimatum. He either signed the Magna Carta or lose his head. And if you read the Magna Carta, that good, beautiful document, you read it carefully, you will see point after point after point where they wanted Talmudic system of government removed and they wanted it returned to the Christian system of government and civic rule. They wanted rid of Talmudism in England. He was forced to sign the Magna Carta. He signed the Magna Carta. And people, historians everywhere say, we don't really know what was the reason behind the Magna Carta. Oh, but isn't it a beautiful document? But if you read it carefully, compare what you read there that they wanted back with the Talmudic system of government. All they wanted was the Talmudic system removed. Well, they got the Magna Carta, but they didn't get the underlying cause removed. It stayed on. And if you let it stay on, it'll start building itself back again. Just chewing away one little bit here, one little bit there. Go to the town hall and have another regulation met. Going up to state legislature and have another state law made just to make it more in compliance with the Talmud. The people weren't satisfied. 75 years later, just a short 75 years later, they went to King Edward I, just in that short period of time. And they said, out. Now history books, well, he didn't want to do it. He says, well, I got to have them. They're my money source. He didn't say that in so many words, but that was his thought. And they said, out. History book says that King Edward I was a racist. He was an anti-Semitic. That's what they call King Edward I. But they left. They were gone. And that was the first of all of the evictions. Yesterday, I told you of the last of the evictions. And I told you that for 1,000 years prior to that eviction was the golden age of Talmudists in Spain. It happens over and over and over. So they didn't rid themselves of the problem until they rid themselves of the root cause of the problem. And they thought at least, they could return to a Christian form of government. With the Judeo-Christianity the way it is, with them eulogizing this system, there are so many of them that eulogize for fear of the Jews, they become Jews, that it is going to be that much harder to even get our people to understand the underlying cause of the problem. But now yesterday, Dick talked about the story of the Jewish and the Zionists funding it and putting it into force and why they were leaving. They want them to have this type of a system to where you have anti-Semitism, painting swastikas on the synagogues and so forth. They want the people to have an ingathering. Now whether we rise to that bait or we just let it happen because it's going to happen is for you all to decide. One way or the other, it's going to happen. We're going to turn our country back to a Christian ethic. Whether in gathering over there is immaterial, but it's going to happen. And Jesus said, those that would not that I rule over them, bring them hither before me and slay them. Eventually, it has to be done back to a Christian ethic and remove Talmudism from our government. Thank you and God bless you.
The preceding circuit riding preacher Peter Peters from the LaPorte Church of Christ, located at the base of the beautiful Colorado Rocky Mountains in LaPorte, Colorado, has been aired on the Scripture for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network and is available on CD or DVD and is archived at the website foramerica.org. Remember, circuit rider, preacher, and teacher Peter Peters broadcasts live nightly from his Wyoming radio ranch, nestled in the Laramie, Wyoming River Valley. It's a working horse and cattle ranch where circuit riding preacher Dr. Peters reaches the lost sheep real worldwide on satellite, internet, and shortwave radio. Dial settings 5755 and 9480. Check out the 24-hour, 7 days a week web broadcasting website, sfawbn.com. For America Worldwide Broadcasting Network is made possible by the prayers and tithes of the faithful. If you want to write to Circuit Riding Preacher Peter Peters, the address is Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 8035. Or you can visit us on the web at www.scripturesforamerica.org. The preacher will be riding back this way next week and hopes you will too.
And greetings to the one.